In this hour's topic, when you think of World War II and its locations, you probably think of Pearl Harbor and Tokyo and Berlin and places where the war was hot. Your top 10 list of places probably would not include the likes of Rio de Janeiro and Mexico City and Buenos Aires, but they too had parts to play in World War II, and those parts are examined at length in a new book by Mary Jo McConaughey called The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. Mary Jo McConaughey knows the region and several others well. She covered wars in Central America and economics in the Middle East and has traveled and worked in dozens of countries. Mary Jo currently works as an independent journalist reporting on Latin America and is the author of two previous books. Mary Jo McConaughey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I'm glad to be here.
Your first sentence produces a bit of a wood, at least for me it did. A million Germans in pre-war Brazil?
Sure. A million ethnic Germans lived in southern Brazil. That's not counting the Germans that lived in other countries, Mexico to Argentina. There were also many, many Japanese, ethnic Japanese, and ethnic Italians, their home countries being those that made up the Axis.
Which, of course, should have caught the attention of American officials. Did it? I mean, was there a big concern in Washington about Latin American potential support for the Axis?
President Roosevelt's deepest concern was Latin America. He worried that the fascism in Latin America could spill over into the United States, that pro-fascists would allow the Nazis to have an entry into the United States. In the late 30s, the war planners from the State Department, the Navy, the War Department had 100 meetings about planning for war. And of those 100, all but six had Latin America at the top of the agenda.
That's really interesting. So all the time that we were thinking that everything was focused on Germany and Japan and Italy, that actually they always had at least one eye on Latin America.
Absolutely. It was so close. And the war planners fixed the southern defense hemisphere, the southern defense line for the United States, not on the Rio Grande River, which you might have supposed, you know, the border between, let's say, Texas and Mexico. Instead, they fixed it right below that hump of Brazil that goes across and Peru. So they felt that that part had to be firmly in United States hands or pro-U.S. hands in order to safely defend the United States.
In these pre-war planning meetings, had the American officials identified areas of resources that they either wanted to make sure that was available for an American military effort or at least to deny for the Axis military effort?
They knew oil was needed. Oil was predominantly in Mexico. It had the biggest reserves in Latin America at the time. There was a big problem because oil had just been nationalized by probably the best president Mexico has had, who wanted to fulfill the measures in the Constitution that would provide some social justice, some equality. He had his own kind of Roosevelt plan for Mexico, but he needed the money from oil to do it, so he nationalized it, which made the big oil companies go over to an embargo forbidding not only the United States, basically, and the European countries to buy it, but also Latin American countries. So the Mexicans, even though they tried to sell to the democracies, ended up selling to a gentleman who sold it to the Reich. His name was William Davis, and he built a big refinery in Hamburg that could make the kind of fuel that would fuel the aircraft of the Luftwaffe, in which case you could say that Mexican oil fueled Hitler's first victories in Poland and France. And he did that by way of a refinery built by his partner, Fred Koch, who is the father of the Koch brothers.
Mm-hmm.
That we hear so much about, Charles and David. And William Davis himself, was the grandfather. These family lines are interesting. of the 37th governor of California, Gray Davis.
Ah, okay. A couple of family ties in here. And there's one of yours as well that you relate in the book. Your father was based in Latin America pre-World War II. Doing what?
Right. Well, my father was a naval officer, and he was based in, you know, the Mediterranean, the Pacific, and in Latin America. Right off of Natal and Florianopolis. And that's what got me curious about World War II in Latin America, because when he was gone, I couldn't find anyone to follow up on his stories with, and I couldn't find any books in English that really gave the big arc of the subject, and it was a big arc. So that's why I decided to write the book I wanted to read.
So this almost sounds like a joke up front. J. Edgar Hoover, Admiral Canaris, and Walt Disney walk into a bar. But, I mean, these and more, and we already talked about the father of the Koch brothers, were figures in the war in Latin America.
Absolutely. J. Edgar Hoover managed to cajole, I would say, the rest of the Washington establishment into getting the espionage brief for all of Latin America, squeezing out the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA, much to the distress of Wild Bill Donovan, the founder of the OSS. And nevertheless, the OSS was able to sneak its own spies into Latin America, including the movie director John Ford working undercover. And Admiral Canaris, of course, was the head of the military intelligence of the Reich, and he had a lot of previous experience in Latin America.
Let's hold the thought there. I want to come back to Walt Disney in just a moment because we have to get to a break. Mary Jo McConaughey is our guest. Her book is called The Tango War, about Latin America in World War II. We'll come back and talk more with her, and you can join the conversation in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the independent journalist Mary Jo McConaughey, who is very well-traveled and has been spending a lot of time in Latin America, researching Latin America's role in World War II, which, although it was not a great place as a battlefield or not well-known as a battlefield, had tremendous importance both in people and in materiel for the war. She's written a book called The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. You can join our conversation on the exchange, share stories, ask questions at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about J. Edgar Hoover, Admiral Canaris, and Walt Disney among the people involved in the region. Admiral Canaris, we were just getting to.
Admiral Canaris was shipwrecked as a young sailor on the island that Robinson Crusoe lived on in the novel. And he managed to make his way in a series of disguises through Latin America back to Germany. And for his feat, he was given his choice of what he wanted to do in the Navy, and he chose intelligence. And the contrast between J. Edgar Hoover and Wilhelm Canaris couldn't be greater. Those are the two spy masters, one of the Axis and one of the Allies, of course. Now, meanwhile, within those two sides, there was competition, some of it ending up in humorous situations and some of it ending up in very serious situations, for instance, between the British intelligence and the U.S. intelligence, and between the military intelligence of Canaris and that of the Gestapo intelligence, which also wanted a piece of Latin America. So there are stories within the stories, and the two espionage networks were pretty close to about the same size in the number of agents. So they were very competitive. Using radio and the Enigma code machine on the part of the Reich and using radio and a lot of clever tricks, many of which shed no blood to achieve their ends.
So why do you call this the Tango War, Mary Jo?
Because the more I researched, the more I saw that for every step one side took, the other took a step that followed. And anyone who's seen a tango knows that it's an intimate dance where the partners closely follow each other's steps. And in fact, one can stand still while the other moves, and then the other can stand still while one moves. And it just seemed to me a perfect metaphor for what was going on.
Very appropriate title for sure. So the book is divided into five parts, and part one is the prizes. We've talked a little bit about oil so far. I want to talk about aviation to start with, though, because that's where you begin. And we already mentioned a large ethnic German population in southern Brazil and then Argentina and other countries as well. Why were there so many German pilots, though, in Latin America?
After World War I, the Treaty of Versailles made it was so punishing to the Germans that young men, and they were all men, who were interested in, well, any careers really, often looked to Latin America as a frontier, but especially pilots, because the Germans were forbidden to have an air force. So many pilots and aviation mechanics, people of that sort, came to Latin America and established airlines. In fact, the first passenger airline in Latin America, established in Colombia, was flying passengers around years before Delta, which is the first U.S. passenger airline, was flying passengers around. And it was really easier to get from Latin America to the heart of Europe, the heart of the Reich, in fact, than it was to get from Latin America to the heartland of the United States in the 30s. So the Germans and then later the Italians were way ahead on controlling the skies over Latin America. This was very worrisome to the war planners in Washington and elsewhere because they flew close to the Panama Canal, for instance. They really controlled the skies, and it was up to diplomats and in some cases counter-espionage agents to get those air routes out of the hands of the Axis powers and into the hands of U.S. flyers.
So how did the Americans make inroads on the German aerial hegemony?
Well, in one case, in Colombia, they did a real fast bait and switch when they discovered that the Colombian airline that they thought was all run by Germans was really run by Juan Tripp, who was the head of Pan American Airlines. And they insisted, out of patriotism, that he needed to get Americans in there to fly. And so they smuggled in over 100 pilots and other personnel, had them communicating in code in Bogota, and one morning just fired all the Germans and moved in all the Americans, and that airline never missed a day of flying. Now, the British got sick and tired of waiting for the U.S. to do a job in Brazil to get rid of the Italian airline. That Italian airline was very dangerous because it was smuggling rare earth materials and contraband and spies right to the heart of the Reich in Berlin by way of Rome. And they did this finally by a ruse using a typewriter built to match the typewriter of the director of the Italian airline, because like Sherlock Holmes says, every typewriter is as individual as a man's handwriting. So they built the typewriter, they wrote the note slammed the president of Brazil as a fat man called the Brazilians monkeys. This is, of course, a phony letter.
It's a forged letter, completely.
A forged letter.
On airline letterhead, wasn't it?
It sure was, because they had the letterhead stolen. And all of this was done at a secret school for spies in Canada by a spy named Intrepid, William Stevenson. And as it turned out, this is one of those situations where not a drop of blood was shed. The Brazilian president himself kicked out the airline.
Oh, because he was the one who got insulted by
someone. Exactly. So they it played on his pride, and it really worked.
Wow. Mary Jo McConaughey, an independent journalist, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book about the Latin American role in the Second World War, and it is much more considerable than you might have thought, is called The Tango War, the struggle for the hearts, minds, and riches of Latin America during World War II. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Before we move off the aviation topic, which is a big one early in the book, who are the Aztec Eagles, Mary Jo?
The Aztec Eagles were a small air squadron that trained in Texas and flew in the Philippines on the side of the Allies. Several of them died in battle, and they were at first rather discriminated against by some of the U.S. personnel. But they proved themselves in the air and on the ground, and were eventually lauded at the end of the war. Although, in Mexico, I found out that despite a huge, beautiful monument to them in Chapultepec Park, in the middle of Mexico City, they're largely forgotten.
You were standing within a few feet of the monument, weren't you?
Well, yes, and I was asking people what they knew about the Aztec Eagles. And frankly, I couldn't get too much response. Excuse me. I couldn't get too much response. The same thing happened in Brazil, where 50,000 Brazilians went to fight in northern Italy. They called themselves the Smoking Cobras. Why? Because Hitler apparently once had said, oh, sure, the Brazilians will fight when the snake smokes. So they called themselves the Smoking Cobras and put that patch on their uniforms. But even now, even though they ended up at the end of the war capturing 14,000 of the enemy, three generals, and many of the elite Italian troops, they came back to Brazil. And because they had been fighting for democracy, and Brazil was a dictatorship, they were shunted into the background. And I managed to talk to some of the veterans, men in their 80s and 90s, who, while very proud of what they did, fighting with the Allies against the Germans and the Italians, they do regret having been put into the background. They weren't even allowed to get a veterans group together until the 1970s.
Oh, wow. Wow. It's no surprise we end up talking about a couple of different resources in the book. We have touched on the oil situation already. I want to get a little more specific on what it was about the Mexican Revolution that essentially put the country on a collision course with the American oil companies.
The Mexican Constitution said that the resources of the country belonged to the people of Mexico. For decades, until Lázaro Cárdenas, the oil under the ground belonged to U.S. companies, Shell, Standard, Texaco. And while Cárdenas was willing to sell at market prices to these companies, there had been so much entitlement among the big oil companies that they rejected that. Now, meanwhile, there was some hypocrisy going on here, because while they fumed against this oil being sent to the Reich through Davis and Koch, for instance, they themselves were selling to the Reich under the table, having their fuel offloaded alongside quote-unquote neutral countries like Spain and Portugal, but knowing full well that that oil went to the U-boats.
Wow, that's still amazing to think that oil from Mexico ended up fueling some of the early efforts of the Axis powers.
Yes, partly because of the greed of the U.S. and other European companies. It those eventually, Roosevelt insisted on some patriotism here, and had them make an agreement with Mexico. But it came very late in the game.
So that was what I was going to ask you about, was what kind of pressure the American government put on it. It sounds like not much. It just let the oil people do what they were going to do.
They couldn't put much pressure on at the beginning. Roosevelt, you see, had a big problem in trying to get the United States into the war to save Britain and to fight against the Reich, because there was a very, very strong isolationist current, a very strong nationalist current in the United States. America First was a huge organization that did not want to go to war. Remember, after World War I, that was the war that was supposed to end all wars, and people did not want to fight again. Roosevelt was up for re-election. If he fought too hard for entry into war, he would lose the election and all his programs would go to waste.
Wow. So he had a lot of political considerations to work on here.
A lot of pressure, a lot of balls to juggle. I think, of course, it was absolutely the attack on Pearl Harbor that took the rug out from under the feet of these America First,
which included the likes of Charles Lindbergh, didn't it?
Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford. Henry Ford, of course, was a fascist and anti-Semite, and made a lot of not just public statements, but funded publications that were anti-Semitic, and was perhaps arguably pro-Reich. Not everyone in America First was, but enough people were to taint it as we look back on it.
Let's move on. We were talking about oil up until now. Let's move on to a different substance also critical to the war effort, and rubber. And this is you went out in the jungle to watch the process of capturing rubber, huh?
Yes, it was for an assignment much later than the end of the war. But nevertheless, I went out with sons of the first, what they called rubber soldiers. Rubber soldiers were recruited from northeast Brazil, which was a drought-stricken, very poor area. And the president of Mexico, after dealing with Roosevelt, recruited these 50,000 rubber soldiers to go into the Amazon. That was the place that was determined to be the best after Japan invaded the countries where our normal sources of rubber were. The war planners had to very quickly look around the world and say, where could we get rubber? Why rubber? It doesn't sound as important, perhaps, as it really is. For war, a battleship has 20,000 parts that require rubber. A fighter plane needs a ton of rubber. And we didn't have synthetic rubber at the time. So these rubber soldiers went into the Amazon jungle, 50,000 strong, but only 20,000 survived the war. They died from malaria, from jungle diseases, from they'd fall in the water and piranhas would attack them, or they died from jaguars. They didn't have the moves and the experience to live in the jungle like natives did. And, you know, there had been on the books a United States operation planned to take that big hump of Brazil, including the Amazon, if Vargas didn't agree to take it with 100,000 U.S. forces. And that operation was called Plan Rubber.
Plan Rubber. Okay. Vargas, of course, the president of Brazil at that time?
Yes, and he was a fascist president. However, he knew which side his bread was buttered on and eventually came over to the U.S. side, especially when promises were made to him to set Brazil on a course of industrialization with steel plants, etc.
We have more stories to actually talk about rubber as we come back and talk to Mary Jo McConaughey more about her book, The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. Henry Ford, Walt Disney, and Nelson Rockefeller appear in the next segment. We'll come back and talk more to Mary Jo in a minute 15 here on The Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Independent journalist Mary Jo McConaughey is our guest on the program in this hour. She has done extensive work in Central and South America and over time came to understand how important the region was to the Second World War, not as a battleground, but as for supplying people and ideas and a lot of raw materials. She wrote the book called The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. You're welcome to join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. We've been talking about the importance of rubber to the war effort. Didn't realize that both fighter jets and other battleships need lots of rubber, and Brazil had a lot of rubber, and we went and got it with the help of the Brazilian government. Earlier issues in the rubber game, though, and this brings us back to Henry Ford. He did some tough work to break a British rubber monopoly earlier. What did he do?
He created an area in the Amazon of plantations and Midwestern-style towns called modestly Fordlandia. And Fordlandia planted rubber trees in rows, as you see in South Pacific plantations, for instance. The problem is that in the Amazon, you can't have plantation-type rubber. I know when I went out with the rubber harvesters many, many, many years later that each rubber tree was separated from another by many other kinds of trees because rubber growing naturally in the Amazon is protected from the kind of blight and fungus that would affect it if it grew in those rows. So he was really trying to apply the assembly line production idea to nature, and nature wouldn't have it. So those huge investments in the towns, in the people, in the plantations failed. Now, whether he would have been able to supply the rubber to the United States during the war, we'll never know, but his own plan failed.
So there's some other big names besides Henry Ford that get into this section of the book. Nelson Rockefeller, later the governor of New York and the vice president of the United States briefly, gets in here, and so does Walt Disney, who we mentioned earlier. What was their involvement in the rubber effort?
Well, one follows the other. Nelson Rockefeller truly loved Latin art and Latin America. Also, his family's company, Standard Oil, had a lot of business down there, and he saw that the Nazi propaganda machine was far ahead of the U.S. propaganda machine by 1940 down there. And he wrote a memo to Roosevelt. He said the Nazi intellectual imperialism of ideas is just as serious a threat as the possibility of a military invasion. Now, the war planners were already concerned about Nazi ideas in Latin America, and they were worried, literally, about invasion, because that hump of Brazil is only 1,800 miles from that hump of Africa that both go into the Atlantic. So one could trampoline to the other. And indeed, the Nazis did take over that part of Africa. But Rockefeller thought that he could spread propaganda by way of magazines, newspapers, competing with the newspapers and magazines that took the fascist line. And finally, he thought, most of all, why not use movies? Use film. Latin Americans were wild about film, but until that time, Hollywood films portrayed Latins in a rather undignified way, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. So his idea was to have, among his goodwill ambassadors, he would bring cultural icons like Orson Welles down to Latin America for public relations. But he thought, how about Walt Disney? And Walt Disney was probably the most successful goodwill ambassador in the entire program there of Rockefeller's, because Disney's films, like the Three Caballeros and Saludos Amigos, portrayed Latin Americans as friendly, as worthy allies. He didn't get rid of stereotypes, that's for sure. But it was a new way of looking at Latin Americans, and a favorable way. Now, Disney also produced a lot of documentary films that were taken around in vans and vehicles with generators to various villages or to the inner suburbs of, or to the inner cities, about health and about agriculture. That Rockefeller's people were able to show to try to raise the way of life in certain places, because these folks were going to be our allies, and we wanted them healthy, and we wanted them, frankly, to be able to produce the food, the coffee, the rubber that we needed.
All right, among the riches of South America, for sure. We're talking to Mary Jo McConaughey about her book, The Tango War, and have a phone call here from Lawrence in Eugene I want to put on the line. Welcome, Lawrence.
Good morning. Along the lines of propaganda, I read a book about Roald Dahl, the children's author, when he was serving with British intelligence, and he got close to the Roosevelt family. In the book, it mentions a completely synthesized map that British intelligence made and planted in Cuba that was then found by Americans, which showed the way Germany was going to realign South America, change the borders, and who would have hegemony over what part of South America. This was a completely made-up map. It wasn't really by the Germans. And yet Franklin Delano Roosevelt referred to that map in a speech that he gave. So it really shows how British intelligence was subtly trying to influence U.S. policy. I'd like to hear the author comment on that.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Lawrence. Appreciate that.
I have a photo of that map in the book. I got it from the Roosevelt papers, and it does show, it's called the secret map, of course, and it does show post-war South America divided into four Nazi territories. It's a very frightening map in a certain way that Roosevelt did not show when he announced its existence on Navy Day in a speech. Now, neither Roosevelt nor Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, the founder of the OSS, who brought him the map from Intrepid, the head of the British Secret Service, ever admitted that the map was a forgery. However, others have insisted that it was. If that wasn't enough to get the U.S. worried about Latin America, I don't know what would have been, but it didn't matter in a certain way because very shortly after that, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and the quote-unquote secret map sort of faded into history.
I see the credit there for the Franklin Roosevelt Presidential Library. Interesting, the map is in reverse because of mimeograph technology. We've been talking generally about resources and more recently with Walt Disney about trying to keep people healthy and interested in helping the war effort. Let's go a little further into people. There's a whole part of the book called The Undesirables, which deals with people not liking other people. There were Jews in Latin America since the 15th century, Mary Jo?
Sure, because that year, 1492, when Columbus sailed, that was the same year that the Spanish monarchs kicked the Jews and the Muslims out of the kingdom. Six Jews went on the crew with Columbus. In fact, the first person to sight land was Jewish, and the first person to set foot on land was also Jewish. They were very few early on, and the Inquisition also was present in the Latin countries. So Jews suffered from that. However, by the end of the 19th century, they were coming as settlers, as agricultural settlers. And there were communities in various parts of Latin America, even synagogues. And until World War II, I'm not saying anti-Semitism didn't exist. It did. But it really flared during World War II to the point that neighbors who lived fairly cozily side by side, who were Jews and non-Jews, in fact, became enemies during the war. It was like lifting the lid off of a box.
Right. So the anti-Semitism definitely flared. How far did it go in Latin America?
Excuse me. One of the tragedies was that the doors closed to the refugees that were coming over. The Italians and the Jews in Germany really needed places to go. But U.S. immigration laws shut them out. And Latin countries shut them out, often referring to U.S. laws, saying, well, if the United States isn't admitting them in, we won't either. There were others who suffered from discrimination during that period, including ethnic Japanese and ethnic Germans. In fact, there was a secret U.S. operation to kidnap more than 6,000 ethnic Japanese and ethnic Germans, bring them to the United States. These are people who were legal residents or even born in Latin American countries, and bring them to concentration camps in the United States, especially to Crystal City, Texas, where the families went, and to use them as trade bait, as hostages to trade for U.S. civilians caught behind enemy lines during the war.
Interesting. So we've talked about the fact that people and stuff mattered a lot to the Second World War effort from Latin America. There was, of course, the Battle of the Atlantic, the scuttling of the Graf Spee, for example. But I want to talk a little more about what went on after the war. Part five of the book is The End Without an End. I mean, and you know, for so many years, people have talked about the fact that major Nazis seem to escape to Argentina and other parts of Latin America. Is that because those were places that had already been home to many Germans?
That was one reason. People knew there were communities there, and so they aimed to go there. I'm talking most egregiously about these guys with blood on their hands, real Nazi killers, you know, people who were involved in organizing the killing in the concentration camps and other prominent Nazis. Now, remember, of course, many prominent Nazis came to the United States to work in our defense and aircraft programs, but others went, thousands and thousands went to Argentina. Their path was smoothed sometimes by the United States, who used the Nazis for their own intelligence purposes toward the end of the war, right after the war, but also by elements in the Catholic Church who were so anti-communist that they figured these fascists would be a bulwark against communism in Latin America.
Oh, wow. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend, or something along those lines.
Very, very much so.
Wow, what a fascinating book and a fascinating time in history. And it's not just around the World War itself, but the things that led up to it. Mary Jo McConaughey takes us through all of it. In The Tango War, the struggle for the hearts, minds, and riches of Latin America during World War II. Mary Jo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I enjoyed it.
Take care.